Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrillo.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everybody. I hope that you have had a good week. We are excited to bring you an episode today. Sebastian, we're going to start off with a little Ted Lasso. First concert, best concert.
What is Ted Lasso?
Number one, Ted Lasso is the greatest show on television.
Okay.
Number two, so you need to just like, we should stop the recording. You should go watch it all. You'll be a better human afterwards.
Okay.
But he is a wonderful, kind, loving person that everyone assumes is an idiot, but he's not an idiot. He's secretly super smart and good with people. It's a great heartwarming show.
And why is this related to Ted Lasso?
So he asks a question of his boss in there that I thought would be a good banter question. That is, he goes, all right, first concert, best concert.
First concert, best concert. Okay. First concert was from, it was a twofer. So there's two bands, Libido and Teca, which were like rockish punk bands back in Peru, back in the day. And I went with my cousins, I believe, and with my mom, I think. I was like, I don't know, 12 or 13 or 14. And then best concert, you know, that's hard because I think best traditional concert I went to, that's really hard. Like, I'll tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of one Taylor Swift concert that she put in such a really good, like, crazy show that I was like, this is not what I expected. And then I'm thinking about this other one that we had in Charlottesville where it was just, like, star after star after star. And I was like, the guy from Coldplay and, like, The Roots. Like, there was, and, like, everything was a surprise. And then I'm thinking of also Bonnaroo, which is like a music festival, which is totally different.
I don't think you can count Bonnaroo, but you know, okay. I like the idea, right?
Okay, yeah. So I was like, if I cannot count Bonnaroo, maybe I don't know. Those two were really, really awesome concerts. Oh, also Red Hot Chili Peppers. Yeah, you know, it's hard, but one of those will be the favorite. What about you? I love this question. Right.
So I'm not sure how to count the first concert. So the first one that I willingly went to, like alone. Right. Was Vanessa Carlton, Goo Goo Dolls, and Third Eye Blind.
Oh, wow. So
classic 90s.
Wait, you know? Where?
So there was like an amphitheater down the street from my house where I grew up. So like, I think we might have even walked to it. It was in Columbus, Ohio. But the first one I actually went to was a babysitter, I think, without permission, took me to Spin Doctors. It was like in a bar somewhere. I think I wasn't supposed to go, but it was like a day concert once.
Wow.
But the best one was easily Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks, and I always forget how to pronounce his name, but like the guy from Fish, Trey Anastasio or whatever.
Okay.
It was just out of this world. So,
wow. That's
what awesome. About you, Allison?
First concert was gloriously a twofer, John Mayer and Counting Crows.
Oh, wow. Like wait, how old are you in this one?
I am 13.
This is which John Mayer verse? This is like Heart of Life, John Mayer?
Yeah, this is early John Mayer, later John Mayer and Counting Crows. Best concert, hands down, no question, Queens of the Stone Age in 2018.
Oh, wow.
Oh my goodness. It was life-changing.
All right.
It was one of those concerts where you're just like, this is what it's about. This is why we're here.
That's
you know,
awesome.
I have to say, I'm not a huge like Deadhead. I like the Grateful Dead and everything, but I recently saw the Grateful Dead with John Mayer in Indianapolis. It was fantastic. John Mayer was like wonderful. Yeah. And I always kind of heard he's kind of a jerk, but like, man, he is good with the Grateful Dead, you know?
Yep. He's good with the Grateful Dead.
Well, before we get too far into making this a music podcast, our special guest today, and I've had name coaching here, is Allison Lidke. She's an assistant professor of economics at St. Olaf College. Her research focuses on the macroeconomic effects of networks. She has a PhD in economics from the University of Virginia. So there you go. Woo-hoo! Go UVA. excuse me. What was that?
Wahoo!
Is that a thing at UVA? Okay, yeah, right. It seemed like so like planned. I was like, that must be.
It's like OHIO, but the UVA version.
Okay, all right. It's like, I'm an Ohio State fan, but I even find the OHIO like I'm aware that's obnoxious.
We're aware it's obnoxious.
And a bachelor's degree in math from William and Mary. So, Allison, thank you for joining us today. And to start off, we'd love to hear a fun fact about yourself. It could be another concert, could be anything you want.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it. So I have a fun fact, unfun fact combo to present to you today. So my fun fact is that when I was at the University of Virginia, wahoo wah, for 5 years for my PhD, my then boyfriend and then husband was in the Army and stationed in Alaska. So throughout those 5 years, I got to fly to Alaska many times a year and see the majesty and the wonder. My unfun fact is that I'm terrified of flying. Like from the moment the plane takes off to the moment it hits the ground, I am apoplectic. And I don't know if you know this, but it takes a long time to get from Virginia to Anchorage. So somewhere between the best you can do is two flights, usually like DC to Minneapolis, where near where I live now. Gotcha. And so it usually takes between 12 and 24 hours to get from DC.
Wow, that's tough.
To Anchorage. And you know, people would always say, oh, well, now you'll get better at it. You'll get used to it. And that's false.
You will not get over your fears. You heard it here first. Yeah.
So what did you do to pass the time? Like, how did you distract yourself? Like unlimited movies, like are you the referee report person?
I went through phases because 5 years is a pretty long time to deal with this. So I went through I'd rather do fewer, longer flights phase. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a movies situation. You definitely want to go with movies to pass the like 6 or 7 hours of each flight. And then after that, I got a little worn out because the part that's hardest for me is being in the air. Taking off, I'm too terrified to see time pass. And I don't mind landing. So I decided to choose like flights where there would be more landing time. Mm. So eventually I did like 3 or 4 flights. Either way, it's terrible. And then you get jet lag because Anchorage is 4 hours.
Have you ever tried the pills?
Yes. So I started, of course, I finally discovered the magic and the wonder of taking Dramamine right before the pandemic.
We're not sponsoring any drug usage on this podcast. Thank you so much. legal issues.
I will say I had some seatmates once that didn't use pills, but they just got super hammered and it was like a 15-hour flight. They were wonderful people to sit right in between the flight. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's of course been recommended to me many times, is just get really drunk, which is a way, but not my chosen way.
Yeah, it's hard to do other stuff after the flight, right? See your in-laws.
Just to put an end to that story, your two-body problem has now ended. Is that correct?
Yes.
Congratulations.
So for the first time in a 7, almost 8-year relationship, we now live under the same roof.
Wow. And you're still together.
Yes. We like each other even more.
Even more. Oh, that's so nice. We should, that's definitely like a two-body problem podcast at some point that needs to get done, because that's a whole different
thing. You just call it the two-body problem?
Yeah. The two. Yeah.
People think it's a physics podcast.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And so before we get into the topic of the day, we just want to talk a little bit about your workflow, just how you work, what do you do, how do you approach, getting the various aspects of your job completed?
That's a great question. So I have to write things down. Everything has to be written somewhere in order for it to enter into my brain. So I brought my planner.
She's showing us a planner right now, by the way.
Yes, it is organized looking.
Yes, and it is color-coded. Every class has a color. Every research project has a color. And this is where I feel I really surpass my peers in like being a little anal retentive. Mm-hmm. Everything that gets accomplished gets crossed off in a different color. And anything that doesn't get accomplished and gets moved to a later date gets crossed off in the same color. So I know whether I accomplished a lot that day or whether I need to move it forward.
That's funny. When did you start this color coding process?
In undergrad, okay. But I definitely embraced the planner life in the first year of graduate school. That was where I really...
Gotcha.
I now keep all of them. So I have all these planners, and every Christmas, my mom gets me a new one. So I spend the lead up to Christmas picking the next one.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what is the, what's the key advantage of the colors? Like how does that help you sort of in like relative to like not having them?
Yeah. I think it's just keeps me entertained. Like it's fun for me. Every morning I sit down to look through the day and write the next day's stuff. Right. Or, weeks out, and it's fun. I look forward to it.
You know what? I actually like that. That's interesting. I'm obviously not a color coding person, but I get the point, right? It's like, imagine if we make the aesthetics and the process of planning something that is super enjoyable, right? Would you be able to do it psychologically more? And maybe the answer is yes, right? Because you actually enjoy the process of planning, which actually ends up being super helpful for like the week. And what about like in the moments where you're like super stressed out, like do you still do that or do you, because you find it relaxing?
Yes. So I do still do it. It's definitely not one of the things that gets dropped by the wayside during very stressful weeks. I almost do it more so that I feel like I have an understanding of what I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So as you're making these lists, can you just give us an idea of like what it kind of looks like? Like you gave an example of like how the different colors are associated with different classes, but like at the beginning of every day, do you have like some master list and then you're like, these are the four things I got to pull from there, or how's it kind of work?
Actually, it's kind of dictated by the kind of planner I've chosen. So I have a weekly planner, which means that there's a few inches for each day. And that's how I decide what gets written down and what doesn't get written down. Some days when I have too much to do, I add a post-it. If I need more room, then like I have to get out a post-it.
Like, oh, this is a bad day. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it's mostly items that need to be produced. I need to write a homework set. I need to write the introduction to a paper. I need to send an email. Those are the typical types of things that get written in each day.
Mm-hmm. I see. Was this one of your items today? Record a podcast?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah, right here.
That's awesome. And oh, nice. Do you use every day, including the weekends, or you not do it on the weekends?
I've been trying to work less on the weekends. Okay. So I sort of purposefully don't write things down on the weekend in an attempt to keep me from doing things.
Mm.
But this weekend is going to be a failure of that plan. Yeah. I know already.
I'm working it too. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
That's right.
Definitely working this weekend.
This is unrelated to our question, but I just love it. Behind Allison right now, she has like a quote that just says everything is figure outable. And I just feel like I don't know why I feel like that's related to workflow, but just like, I feel like if you're a planner person, somehow that quote is like related to that. Like I can figure out my plan, get it in this planner and like get it to work.
It's also sort of part of my teaching philosophy that nothing is too hard for you. You can figure it out, and I'm here to help you.
So before we get into today's topic, we want to hear a little bit about something you're working on or just something you want to promote. Is there anything of that nature you'd love to share?
Yes, absolutely. So I study the economics of networks, which means I'm really interested in how the connections between people or places or things affect their decisions and then affect the macro economy. So there's more traditional versions of that that I'm working on right now. I have a paper with my thesis advisor at the University of Virginia, Eric Young, where we look at financial networks, which are the loan relationships between banks. And we try to use that to see if we can identify structurally important banks to try and prevent these cascading financial failures that were such a big problem in 2008. And then when I was writing that paper, I realized that I needed to take a step back and write a different paper that makes an even more straightforward point, which is that the connections that exist between people, banks, schools, firms, whatever, really matter. Whether they exist, whether they don't exist, the specific ones that are there can lead to huge differences in aggregate outcomes. And I feel like we really don't study that very often. So I took a step back and I wrote sort of a shorter paper that just said the links that exist between banks can have enormous effects on financial volatility overall. So those are my two sort of traditional ones. And then I have I've sort of started to explore different ways of looking at that question and looking at those connections and seeing other ways I can ask that question. So I'm working on a paper with Carly Urban at Montana State, looking at how the connections between high schools affect the types of financial education classes that they offer? And do your peers influence the types of decisions you ask, even above and beyond regulations you face, county level stuff, state level stuff? Are your peers driving that? Yeah.
So this is really cool to me. And I just have a question about like how you measure some of this stuff. Cause I imagine like a part of the reason that like people don't study this is cause like, it's hard to measure. And like the only stuff I'm familiar with where I've like read a couple papers on physician networks and like, not that it's wrong, but it's like kind of incomplete. They just like look at, they use a data set and they're like, how many patients are shared by these physicians? Mm. But like, there's all sorts of other reasons why patients are shared in banks. Do you do like the same thing with customers or like how are you thinking about networks?
Yeah. So one of the biggest problems and a point that I make in that volatility paper is that we do not have the data we need to answer these questions sufficiently. It's always a problem to have incomplete data, but to have incomplete data describing networks is a really big problem. And there are very few data sets that have truly complete information, which is why so many of the papers you see in this area are very theoretical. So that's why, and that's also why I wanted to try out this high school peer network thing, or I'm working on a paper with Emily Cook and Riley Acton, where we do sort of a college version of that, looking at how colleges chose to open in fall of 2020 in the face of COVID. Were they driven by their peers' decisions when they were choosing a reopening scheme? And part of the reason I wanted to pursue those projects is because there you're actually constructing the network yourself. You are saying, this is the network. Now let's figure out how it affects things instead of going out and trying to find a network.
When you talk about networks, the one thing that comes to my head is like spillover effects. And maybe that's a way of mentioning networks. We had earlier in the podcast, Abehi Yoha, who had his job market paper. Know. Oh, okay. So like, maybe help me tie there is like, is she also measuring networks or she's doing something different than the networks, right?
Yes, absolutely. And after I listened to that, I paused that podcast and emailed her to ask her if she wanted to organize a session with me.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome.
Yes. So she's studying, you know, things that I have also looked at that I'm very interested in. So I was thrilled to hear about her research.
Cool. So networks can be the, I guess, broadly defined and then in each context, it may be measured differently, whether that's in physicians' cases and whether that's banks like, you know, customers or whatever other kinds of definitions of networks we can find.
Many, many different definitions. Yep.
Gotcha.
As long as there's an economic agent and a relationship between them, you've got yourself a network.
But maybe that's a great place to pause and shift topics to talk about the topic of the day. So today we're going to have a conversation with Allison about procuring a liberal arts job or like it's a LAC, a LAC. Every time I see LA, I think like Latin America. So I'm like procuring a job in Latin America, which is very different, which she has done this twice now. So we believe that she has good experience in it. So in order to get things started, tell us a bit about your graduate experience, maybe we can start there. And when you realize that going into a liberal arts school would be a really good place or fit for you.
My story of how I realized that a liberal arts college job was going to be right for me started in my undergraduate experience. So I went to the College of William and Mary for my undergraduate degree. And because no one else in my family had been to college, that was the only data point I had in my head. I was just like, all colleges are like this college. And this college is very teaching focused and very student focused.
Right.
And so I thought, who wouldn't want to work in that environment? This is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. Right. And I sort of gleaned from conversations with other people that, okay, if I want to do this, the way to do it is to get a PhD. Mm-hmm. And then I realized the way to get a PhD was to get a PhD in economics. And so I decided to pursue an economics PhD. And then I ended up at the University of Virginia, which for a research university is still very student focused. Mm-hmm. But compared to the College of William and Mary, it was a whole different can of tomatoes. That first year where I was at a research university, I was blown away by how different it was. And so part of that, realizing that it was going to be so different, it wasn't going to be as teaching focused as my experience had been, made me think, okay, so clearly there's different types of schools.
Right.
Totally. What are those types? How do I find the right type? And so throughout my graduate experience, pursuing teaching opportunities, pursuing people who also felt that way, I eventually gleaned, oh, okay, so liberal arts colleges are where they're going to be really focused on the teaching and really focused on working with students, mentoring, doing research with them, just being more of a small campus community where everybody works together.
From your story that I heard is, I wanted to be in a place like this. So if I want to be faculty in a place like this, I need to go through the PhD. Was there any point in that process in which you were talking to some mentors out of ACs and they were like, but that's great, but remember that the main point of the PhD is to do research and they only teach you to do research. And then the kind of like the second question to tack into that is, like, did you had an expectation that while you're doing your PhD, they're going to teach you how to teach? Because spoiler alert, they don't teach us how to teach.
They do not. No, so I did not have, that I remember, any mentors that said like, okay, heads up, you're going to get there and it's going to be a totally different thing.
Right.
And they are not going to focus on teaching. They're not going to, it's going to be a totally different environment. And I'm assuming that they thought I knew that. I think that most of my mentors thought, oh, well, she's going to go get a PhD. She's going to try and be a professor. I'm sure she knows that there are other types of schools out there that aren't this type of school. Yes. And then as you pointed out, they do not teach you how to teach.
Yeah.
That's such a funny thing to me that like, cause I also didn't really realize this like quote unquote secret lives of professors that like occurs behind the scenes when I was a student. Like it's so funny to try to think back to how you were as a student and what you think professors did outside of the classroom. And like, I went to Miami University where your co-author Riley is at now. And it's like kind of like a liberal arts college in their focus on teaching. But like, I just thought they were like kind of like high school teachers, right? Like I had no idea. Until like maybe my third year research occurred.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say William & Mary is a similar type of thing as Miami in that the students feel like it's totally student focused, but it's not, you know, the faculty feel, you know, it's very research focused.
So that's super interesting. Okay. So you then just to connect the dots, realized I had this epiphany of like, okay, these are the kinds of schools that I want to end up because I really value that student connection, especially at the college level. So then conditional on you have been at that point, what did you like took some steps? Like, I mean, at that point, I feel like there's so many things you can do because in the PhD, again, they don't teach us how to teach. But maybe you're like an innate teacher or an educator. There's things like the Center for Teaching. There's so many things one can do. So let maybe talk about that.
Yes. So once I figured out that's what I wanted to do, I took every teaching opportunity I could. Okay. So I loved being a TA. And while I was being a TA, I realized that there might be a chance for me to get to teach my own class over the summer. And so I sort of waged a campaign to get them to let me teach intermediate math.
To the econ department or like who was the campaign for?
Yeah. So in the econ department, it waxes and wanes, but when I started trying to get this, they weren't very interested in letting a graduate student teach their own class. Because
even over the summer?
We had the exact opposite experience and where I'm at, our graduate students also teach. Like you were expected to teach your own class as a sole instructor of record. We had a version of how to teach, but like it was lacking in many ways. I mean, I learned a lot, but like, it wasn't like, here is a syllabus, here's this, right? It was like a person sharing their thoughts. It was kind of like a weekly podcast with this guy that knew a lot of stuff. but like, I guess I just want to say that's not the, maybe that is the normal experience, but it wasn't at least my experience.
Right. It may or may not be, right? Depends on the university. Right. You're totally right. Yeah.
Right. And I have spoken with a lot of people, especially people who work at liberal arts colleges, and they all have very different experiences. I have a lot of colleagues who had to really ask, had to really push to get to teach their own classes. And I have colleagues that's almost silly to them to think because they had to teach so many classes on their own.
So sorry, you were telling us about you were doing a campaign to let you teach a class while you're doing your PhD. And as you continue that story, I did want to ask one question, which is, was there a moment in which you were like, I'm going to be open about this decision and like not care about what people think? And I asked this question because there's obviously this idea that people say that it's like, well, you don't tell, you know, your advisors that you want to focus on that because some people just care about research.
So this may come as a surprise to you, but I'm not very good at hiding my feelings about anything.
Me neither.
It's never a mystery to anybody who's in the same room as me how I feel about anything at a given moment. So it never really occurred to me to hide it from my advisor, but my advisor was great about it. I told him, this is what I want to do. I definitely want to end up at a school where teaching is a high priority, someplace like William and Mary or a liberal arts college like where I am now. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense. You definitely do want to do that.
Okay.
And of course, Eric Young went to Washington and Lee. So he knew the magic and the wonder of a liberal arts college. I also had a lot of support from people like Lee Kopic and Ken Elzinga at UVA, who do a lot of mentoring of the people who are so passionate about teaching. So when I waged that campaign to try and get a class of my own, I had, you know, a great supporter and mentor in Lee Kopic, who was one of the people at the time who chose the instructors for over the summer.
So I have a question. I think it's great that you did that and you sort of went out of your way to create this signal of how interested you are in teaching. But I'm curious, like in the liberal arts job market, like, does it matter to have previously taught a class as a sole instructor of record? Like, do you think that really gave you a leg up getting this job? Or do you think like there's enough people that have never taught a class that they'll judge you from your presentation or something?
So I get a lot of questions about this from people who are on the job market now saying, is it going to kill my chances to get a job at a liberal arts college to not have taught my own class? And the answer to that question is no, because there are ways that you can signal that you take it seriously, that you've thought carefully about how to be a good teacher. But in my case, especially because not that many people from UVA had gone on to liberal arts colleges jobs. Right. It was very much not the norm. And so it was very important because of that to send a signal that one, I take it very seriously, but also that the people who know me, the people in the department there think I can handle it. I think that played a big role in me getting the interviews and then jobs that I got, was that it showed that the faculty had faith in my teaching ability as well.
I was told, at least during the market, that liberal arts schools, yes, they're interested about some unobservable component about you do being a good teacher and educator, but they also really do care about you being a good researcher as well. And I think sometimes I feel like people just be like, oh, it's all about teaching, when in reality, I also think it has to be like high quality research, right? Is that, what's your conception there, that some schools do care about research or not? Or
oh, they absolutely do. I mean, I would not, you can't get a liberal arts faculty job without incredible research. And I've talked to so many different departments at this point, because I went on the job market twice in 3 years. So I've interviewed with a lot of different liberal arts colleges, and there's just so much variability in what they envision themselves as, what they envision their department
that's
as.
That's so important. Yeah.
Some places see themselves as research schools where you also happen to be absolutely magnificent teachers. Mm-hmm. And some places envision themselves as sort of fully enclosed campus communities where this great research happens, but students can witness it and be part of it. And they're also incredible teachers. It's just sort of different views of the purpose. But all of those views feature really strong research.
I see. So that's important. So then to highlight your answer is, there's going to be slightly different sets of objectives that each liberal arts schools will have, but embedded in those objectives, there's always going to be a component of research, and presumably also an important component about what they think makes a really good either mentor, advisor, or educator.
That's exactly right. And the other thing I would say is great about working at a liberal arts college is that some of the places specifically design their research requirements for tenure so that you can dream big, try crazy ideas, aim really high, and take that time that it takes to get something published. Like, as we all have experienced, it takes forever to get stuff published. And if you have really, really high number requirements for papers, then you have to be strategic about where you send them. Yeah. And so places like where I am have specifically designed the number that you need to get to be low enough that you can aim really high the first few times. And that way you don't have to try and get 1,000 papers written. You can get a few written and aim all of them really high at first, and then, you know, see how that goes, and then aim again.
So you knew that this is something you were interested in ahead of time. I think there's a lot of students that may, you know, haven't been to a liberal arts college. Maybe they went to a state school, or they're an international student. You know, how do you, like, how can someone tell if this is for them? Or, you know, I don't want to ask you a cheesy question like that, but like, I guess
make it, extra cheesy, because I love cheese. So yeah,
give me some cheese whiz or something here.
Well, my first suggestion is to go ahead and try teaching. See how you like teaching. If you love it, if that's the thing that you wake up for every day in graduate school, that you're like, yes, I get to teach today, even if it's a discussion section, then pursue that. See how that goes. You know, one of the great things about working where I work is that I get to work on research for 6 hours or for one day of the week. And then I get to shift gears and go to teaching. And that makes me better at both things. And so if that's the type of person you are, where you go like full pedal to the metal on your research, and then, you know, you hit a hurdle and you get stuck and you get frustrated with the code and you want to throw it out the window, then you get to go teach. You break stuff down into its individual components. You teach it to the students. You communicate clearly. It sort of resets your brain, and you come back to the research and you're better at it. So if that's the type of thing that you like doing, you like that kind of balance, you like getting up in front of students and imparting knowledge to them, then I would at least think about it. Ask around, you know, do the classic networking advice that people give. Ask to get coffee with someone who does the job you're interested in, and ask them about their day. See if that kind of day speaks to you.
Right. Totally. And just to talk about broad characteristics that people may not know about. So are you expected to, any expectation, do we teach more in liberal arts schools than we do in Research One universities, or is that a myth?
Yes, no, that's true. But it's not onerous most of the time.
Okay.
I mean, there's huge heterogeneity in people's preferences, right? So I have interviewed for jobs where I have to teach a 4-4. We have to teach 4 classes in each semester, and I'm still expected to write some papers. And I've interviewed for jobs all at liberal arts colleges where I'm expected to teach a 2-2. And, you know, there's variability there, but on average, yes, there's maybe one more class per semester.
Okay. One thing I did not know in grad school is what those numbers 2-2-1-3 meant. Let me explain right now, and you guys tell me that if I'm wrong. So I could, for example, have a load that is, well, right now is 0-3, which means in the fall.
Boo this man.
That is a great
point. No, it's a great. Sorry, I didn't interrupt you. I'm just jealous.
Yeah. Which I teach right now 0 in the fall and 3 classes in the spring. But then 2 of those classes are actually one course. So it's just 2 sections of one course. And then the other one is a different course. There is another year in which I did same load, which is a 1-2, right? Total 3, but there were 3 different classes. So is that how you guys also understand load numbers?
Yep. That's exactly how we understand it. So that would, if you were telling me about your 0-3, I would say that's a 0-3, but with only 2 preps.
Right. Oh, great. Because then this is the language of the prep, right? 0-3 with only 2 preps.
And that's the preparation, right? So there's only, that's where that doubling of the course happened. And just to echo Allison's experience, I also interviewed with a few liberal arts colleges. And like I currently, at a non-liberal arts college, teach a 2-2 with three preps. And I interviewed with some liberal arts colleges where I would have had a lower teaching load, right? So
right.
It's not necessarily that it's a guarantee that at the liberal arts college, there's-
Right, because the preps are really big time consuming things, right?
Yes,
so
they are.
You may have like a four, a zero or 0-4 or whatever, but only have one prep. That could actually look very different than a zero.
That'd be a whole different thing.
Different preps.
Yeah. And I want to also ask a question because I've heard, I have friends at various types of LACs as well. And I don't want to like talk about the specific institution because that's not necessarily important, but I have a friend at one place where they are expected to be like really like almost on call for their students. So like emails are not just responded to immediately, but like thoroughly explained. Office hours are like, I'm not trying to say like the professor is like an entertainer or something, but like they're almost like having another class where they're like reteaching things and like, cause the students are really into it. And I know that differs across space at all. Could you maybe expand, like, am I correct there? Or is that a wrong perception?
Yes. Yeah, so that is true. Some places that's not true for me. Our chair works really hard to protect our number of preps, like we were discussing. And to sort of protect the idea that there's many different ways to do this well. If the best way for you to do it well is to do that, you respond to emails immediately and you put on basically another class during office hours. If that's the way for you to do it great, that's great. But if that's not the way for you to do it great, that's okay too.
I think the other point there that maybe it's important is you may land a job in a liberal arts school and maybe not necessarily like the experience there, but that probably doesn't mean that you still don't like all liberal arts schools, right? So maybe can you talk a little bit about that and maybe your experience with that?
Yes, that's very true. And that I sort of saw that and felt that both times I was interviewing, I knew this is what I wanted to do. I had a vision in my head of teaching really well and engaging with the students and working with them on research projects and, you know, an academical village life. And I interviewed with plenty of liberal arts colleges where that was not their vision. And that didn't change my opinion that I knew this was right for me. That was clearly the perfect job for someone else who loved liberal arts colleges. I have friends who teach at liberal arts colleges who when we see the same job or often we interviewed for the same jobs, and there would be ones that I loved and I would have loved to go to and I was so excited about. And, you know, my friends who have very similar jobs were like, I would never go there ever after hearing. So there's a huge variety in positions and a huge variety in preferences of people who want to work at those places.
So this is like great information to start to like talk about, like, hey, there's a lot of heterogeneity here. So like, let's say you're a student and you're like, I'm on the market or I'm going to be on the market in a couple of years. Like, I want to know more about those things. Like, it's like, that's not really like Googleable. Like, so I know you mentioned like, well, like ask someone to get a coffee, but like, is there a way to try to like figure out some of these things that is less time intensive for like a curious graduate student?
I don't think so. Not that I know of. I mean, most of it for me, I think it's just like every other type of job on the econ job market is you have in your head, you know, you fill out all these applications and you have these ones in your head that are like the perfect one. You're like, surely they will contact me. That's the one I want. And then of course, there's always like 50% of those ones that you're like, that's the one I'm perfect, that they never get in touch with And then you do the interviews and you redo that whole process. And there's three that you're absolutely in love with. And you're definitely going to go there. And you're kind of stressed out about the idea of choosing between those. And they don't get in touch with you either. So it's the same process of talking to the schools, learning about the people, going there, which I realized we couldn't do this time on the job market. But that's so important to figure out if the environment, the colleagues, the community is a good fit. Mm-hmm. It's possible that maybe that's more of a thing in liberal arts colleges, that there's more variability and figuring out if that one is the right one takes more of that experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm also thinking like about Alex's question, in which maybe some students are like, well, I'm just trying to find a job, right? So like, I'm going to choose among the set of things that they actually give me an offer. And maybe through the FIO to learn that process. And so maybe, can you tell us a little bit about what's your sense of like, you know, what are liberal arts schools looking for when in the market? And what are ways that maybe in that process of the interview or the file, you can do some signaling that could be really appealing to those institutions?
My impression is that that's really hard no matter what type of position you're looking for. It was certainly true for me. So one thing you can do, this is true of every job in economics, I think, is be really interested in the job. Ask questions. Show that you looked into that particular school and that particular position and have thought carefully about how you personally and not someone else would fill it. And I think that's especially helpful for liberal arts colleges. Okay. The other thing I would say that you can do to signal that this would be good for you, that you would be a good fit for this, is talk about working with students. Ask questions. This was my go-to question both times I was on the job market. I would ask about their research opportunities with undergraduates. Sometimes there was like a name for the program, and I would be like, can you tell me a little bit more about the McNair Scholars?
Right.
Have any of you done a project like that? What was your experience?
But now you can't, now no one can use it because everyone is going to use the Allison question and the new equilibrium emerges. No, I'm just kidding.
So yeah. I actually like that quite a bit. Yeah. So somebody that gave me like when they were a fifth year, I was a fourth year, and they gave like tips for doing well in the market. They had this phrase that I still tell students now, which is use questions, not as an opportunity to learn information, but as an opportunity to signal interest in the interviews. And that's like kind of stuck with me in like many different settings where like, it's kind of like, what are you going to learn in there? Like, oh, how much do you pay me or whatever? But you could be like, you know, like, hey, I see you have this cool thing, meaning like, I looked at your website and took this seriously, you know, like.
We wanted to ask you first if you had any kind of like other little thought that we didn't really get to touch on.
Well, I do have one more tip. This is a tip that I give to students who ask about how they can signal to liberal arts colleges that they're really interested, especially if they are at a school where there's fewer teaching opportunities, where there's fewer independent teaching opportunities. Most schools, like you actually mentioned a little earlier, Sebastian, have a center for teaching, the Center for Teaching Excellence. Ours is the Center for Innovation in the Liberal Arts here. Most schools have something like that. And most of those places have programs that they run to help you become a better teacher. So at the University of Virginia, the Center for Teaching Excellence has sort of a fellowship program where you apply and they help you become a better teacher. They observe your classes, they require you to reflect on the teaching process, all of which was incredible preparation for writing teaching statements and for getting letters saying that I was a good teacher. So make sure you seek out, probably outside of your department, opportunities to get feedback on teaching, to participate in these types of programs with students from all over the school who also care about teaching. Because that made a huge difference for me.
That's super interesting. And that makes me think about a question, which is, let's say I did my first teaching gig and it did not go so hot as a PhD student. And so my eval is not that great. Aside from being honest, I guess, which is maybe the simple answer, maybe help us understand how to construct a narrative that can still be helpful in for that person who still wants to get a job in the liberal arts school.
I think that it's almost better to have a really bad first go.
Oh, okay.
Because then you can construct the narrative where you grew. This is even advice they give to me and other junior professors at liberal arts colleges, is the first year very well may be a total tire fire. And that's okay, because what's really important for tenure and what's really important in applying for jobs is showing that you took the information in, thought carefully about it, and then implemented some change. It's almost better to say, well, I tried working in small groups, but that completely crashed and burned. So then I tried this different teaching method and that went a little better. So I thought I would try this other thing. It's almost better to experiment and see things fail and then talk about how you learned from that in order to get this type of job.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I had an experience in my there's just one time teaching this class, health economics. And in the end, I didn't think I did a really good job. And it was my first time teaching it. But then I was like, okay, I know so many things that I would do different for the next time. And it's funny, I haven't had the chance to you know, teach it again. But in one of my annual reviews, that, again, that's another thing we should probably talk about at some point, that having jobs, they were like, oh, so, you know, this class, you didn't do so well. And I was like, you know what? Yeah. And the students are right. Like, it wasn't a great class. And I'll tell you why it wasn't. And I'll tell you what I was trying to do and why I failed at doing it. And I mean, again, this is maybe specific to Batten, but I think my senior colleagues were like, okay, cool. Like, makes sense. Like, what you're saying is not crazy. You know, as long as you're not insulting students, like, you know, that kind of stuff. So
I had a similar experience where the first time I taught a stats class, I like made it way too hard. And then I like spent the next year like thinking about it a lot, where I was like, why did I do, like, why was it too hard? And like, I went up and down, and then I like basically reprepped the course. And the next time I taught it, like, not only did the evaluations improve, but I was like, oh yeah, I did a terrible job teaching that the first time. I tried to teach like in an intro stats class fixed effects. That's a bad mistake. You know, I don't know why I did that.
No, for sure. Teaching is hard, guys, by the way. Like, if you haven't taught before, if there's people in this listen to this podcast, you haven't taught before, it's funny, because like, you can spend little time and get by, but if you want to create a good product, is not easy, especially for those of us who have not learned how to teach. And that's why the Center for Teaching or any of those kinds of resources where you're learning how to be an educator are super important.
So basically, Allison's like, very brief story was, went to an awesome liberal arts college that was student-centered, and then realized very quickly there is a spectrum of how students are thought of at different universities and colleges. Some think of them, you know, as you know, a thing that happens on Tuesdays where research happens on all the other days, you know, as like almost an afterthought, whereas other places, you know, it's all about the students. And even among liberal arts colleges, there's a spectrum of where students are. Even if they're the linchpin, it may be that everything is teaching, or it could be that like they want a full research plus full teaching plus like, you know, like some like city on the hill or something. So let's say you think you want to be involved with one of these liberal arts colleges. What should you do if you're a PhD student? Well, one thing is to teach. And at many places like where I went, like, you can teach and you could teach a lot of classes if you wanted to. I actually had cohort members that taught 6 or 7 college classes, and even taught at the high school level at nearby charter schools. So you could do that, but many of you may be at institutions where that's not possible. So just do what you can to signal that you're interested in it. If you can teach a class, awesome. But if you can't, that's not going to prevent you from being able to be interviewed by a liberal arts college. The key is to get it in the letter and teaching statement and to truthfully signal your interest in one of these places. And the efforts by trying to teach or having taught a class, even if it's not common, will hopefully help convey that. And in addition to this, you could go to the Center for Teaching and Learning. You could perhaps have certificate programs or other, you know, sort of peer observation things that you could do. And we didn't actually talk about this, I think, much in the podcast, but even if you're a person who's like, I don't think I want to go to liberal arts college, I just want to interject. I think it's really valuable to engage in all of these types of things. Number one, like, kids pay a lot of money for education. So like, we want to deliver education to them. And number two, even if you don't care about that, if you're like, why would I care about that? It makes your presentations better. I really find it like, it sort of all interacts with each other.
Yes. That was really good. Thank you for saying that.
Like I said, both things make me better at the other thing. Teaching makes me a better researcher. Research makes me a better teacher.
Every week, we like to ask our guest for a recommendation of the week. This could be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, a kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Allison, what is your recommendation for the week?
This is one that definitely improves my life in a small way. This is a cocktail recommendation.
Yes! That I learned about. The first cocktail recommendation.
From someone on Twitter. So someone I've never met, Ashani Kanpal. We were having a conversation on Twitter about Manhattans, and she recommended to me the cocktail, the Green Point, which is very much like a Manhattan, very whiskey focused, very bitter. That's my favorite part of Manhattans, is the bitters, except that you add yellow chartreuse to it. And yellow chartreuse is like this sort of bitter herbal.
It's an intense liqueur. Is it a liqueur or is it a liquor?
Liqueur. Yeah. Now I don't know what the word for it is, but it's strong. Amazing. Yes, it's very strong. And I tried this cocktail after she recommended it, and it's a new favorite. So if you are the type of person that likes those bitter, boozy cocktails, this is one for you for sure.
That's awesome. And if you're over 21 too, thank you.
Yes.
Great. Alex, what is yours?
So I have recently signed up for this. I'm normally like pretty anti like signing up for spam. But I signed up for this thing called Bright by Text. And basically it's just like, I think like once a week, or maybe you can set your preferences, but whatever. I get it like once a week, and just like information for parents about like what you can do with your kid. So like, it's like from PBS or like NPR or some combo of those makes it. So you can sign up for it by texting Bright to 274448. And then if you do that, they'll just ask you like the gender and age of your kid. And I think maybe your zip code. And then like once a week, I get something that like, you can, so my daughter's about to turn one, be like, just remember, you could like ask your kid like a little quiz question every now and then, like, we're about to go eat. Should we take the spoon or should we take this like toy boat? And they're like, this helps your kid do blah, blah, blah. And like, I don't know.
Toy boat.
Yeah, always take the tugboat to help eat. That's the correct answer, clearly. But like, it just like tells you like, here's why you should do that. And it just gives me a little extra piece of information. Cause like, I don't know.
That is nice because it makes you more secure maybe about the parenting.
Yeah, not just that, but like, I'm not like around a lot of other parents right now. So like, right. I was like, oh, that's smart. I'll do that.
Right. Makes sense. I love it. Thank you, Sebastian. My recommendation of the week, it's I don't know if it's controversial or not, but this was told to me by my advisor, Kit Carpenter, which is, you know, submit your job market paper. As simple as that. Let me tell you a very brief story. So I did it. I submitted my job market paper kind of like the first year that I was a professor. Yeah. You know, tried some places, got rejected, kept trying. And there was one place that gave me some referee reports, and it was a rejection. And then I was like, you know what? Okay, these referee reports are actually really useful. I'm going to do those things and then resubmit it. And that was a mental block because my head was like, oh gosh, I have to do this referee reports and then submit it. And it really pushed when I finally was able to resubmit it. My job market paper was accepted this year. That's like 5 years after I graduated. And maybe that's not going to look so hot, but you know what? I want other people to learn from my mistakes. Just, you know, I know it sucks. I know you may don't like that paper at that point, but just keep pushing. That's my recommendation.
Sebastian, I talk about this, I think, like not on the podcast a lot. Like nothing from my dissertation is published, and it like sucked the first couple of years because I would send it out. I'd get the referee reports, and then I would spend like 6 to 8 months like working on stuff. And like, you know, it was exactly that kind of resistance or fear or whatever you want to call it. And like, it's real. So I'm on board with submit your job market.
Easier said than done for sure.
I guess I want to add another recommendation of the week because Sebastian was unaware of it. Watch Ted Lasso, people. That show's great.
That's fair.
I just wanted to echo the recommendation to submit your job market paper. My first year out of my PhD, my goal was to get my job market paper submitted before the end of the first semester. And you know what? I submitted it while I was sitting in the final for my class.
Well done.
So the last possible day, I accomplished that goal. Cross it off in a different color in the
final. Nice. That's awesome. Good. I love it. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
Well, you can certainly find me on Twitter. My handle is @LidkeyAllison. But you can also find out more information about my research and my teaching at my website, which is aolidkey.com.
Great. Awesome. And we'll have the links on the show notes. That's all we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you for tuning in. See you next week. Bye.
Thank you.